Welcome to The Mental Breakdown, where we tackle all issues related to mental health, mental illness, parenting, schooling, relationships, and everything in between. While Drs. Bernie and Richard will provide the most up-to-date ideas and perspectives, the information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for medical care. Our goal here at The Mental Breakdown is to provide you with information to help you make your life the best it can be. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bernie and Dr. Richard. Welcome to episode 3 of The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
This week we're going to expand a little bit on our discussion from last episode. If you haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, I encourage you to check it out. Remember, it's on iTunes, as well as our blog at thementalbreakdown.com. Just as a refresh, the last time we talked with you, we spoke about the relationship between mental health and mental illness. In that episode, we kind of talked about Dr. Richard's and my perspectives on how we should be thinking about mental health, how we should think about mental illness, and what it means for all of us. So today, what we're going to do is we're going to express it a little bit more, expand it to include the idea of violence, mental health, mental illness, and violence. If you watch the news or you watch even television programs, you're often probably left with the impression that there's a strong relationship between mental illness and violence. In fact, in a lot of television programs and movies, the main villain tends to have or be depicted by some form of mental illness. So today, we're going to talk about what that relationship really is, and we're going to highlight that with a few recent cases, as well as we're going to kind of go old school and talk about a couple of older cases, just to demonstrate the fact that this relationship is largely small, actually, to say it in a very strange way, I suppose. The relationship isn't very strong. If we look at some of the information from most of the medical associations, the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association, the ideas are pretty consistent that there's a small relationship between violence and mental illness. Most mentally ill people do not commit violent crimes, and most violent crimes are not committed by mentally ill individuals. So we're going to start out with a new case or a newer case from the last year or so, and it's actually a court case going on right now, and that's the case of Zohar Sanaya. Dr. Richards, share with us a little bit about that case.
You know, after we did that podcast last week about mental health and mental illness, and that we discussed them as being on a spectrum, with health on one end and mental illness on the other end. And in the course of the week, you know, I kept thinking about this notion of mental health and mental illness. And there was a special program about this Zohar Tsarnaev that, of course, is one of the brothers involved in the Boston Marathon bombing. And his defense attorneys have already acknowledged that he is guilty of the crime. That is no longer the issue in this trial of whether he was there, whether he's guilty. He is guilty. Even his defense attorneys acknowledge that. What they're trying to do, and the reason this case is getting so much attention, is that when the government sought the death penalty, his defense attorney's strategy became one of avoiding execution. And to avoid execution, they're going to have to convince the jury that he was not the main antagonist, the perpetrator of this, but rather it was his brother who had been converted to violent jihad, and that this 19-year-old boy simply went along with his brother and was under the influence of his brother. And so it got me to thinking about this issue again, that here's a kid, 19 years old. Was he mentally ill? Was he mentally healthy? Was he a typical teenager who was just turned violent by his brother? Or where did the violence come from? Because when these violent acts, especially what most of us consider inexplicable acts of violence, such as the Boston Marathon bombing, the Sandy Hook massacre where Adam Lanza went into that elementary school and shot people. We can go way back to Columbine in 1999. When these violent acts happen, we try to understand, we seek some explanation for why these things occur. And they're so horrific that we typically begin to think of, well, this person must be mentally ill. Only somebody who's mentally ill could commit an act of this degree. Other explanations are, well, this is pure evil. But pure evil really isn't an explanation that helps us. Other people say, well, this is the devil at work in the world. This is people of faith take a biblical view of this. But most of us almost automatically move to this person must be mentally ill in order to commit such a horrific act.
So, Dr. Richard, what it sounds like you're saying is that for most of us to digest that something like this could happen, it's easier for us to understand it if we say, well, that person was damaged in some way, they had a mental illness, and that's why they did it, because we don't want to be left with the idea that this could happen to anybody.
Right, right. And I think it creates two problems for all of us. On the one hand, we are attributing violent acts to mental illness when, in fact, most people who are mentally ill do not commit violent acts. And the second problem it creates is that if we use mental illness, the mental illness explanation is not a sufficient explanation for violent acts. So it doesn't get us any closer to understanding these acts or preventing them or deciding what we should do about them.
Right. And so what we're really looking for is the easiest explanation for us to handle.
Right. The most parsimonious for us, the most reasonable explanation to explain the horrific acts. My goodness, just this past week, we had a German airline co-pilot lock the pilot out of the cabin and purposely fly the jet into a mountain, killing everybody aboard. We can't understand, we can't embrace why anybody would conceivably take a whole plane load of people and kill them in a single act of violence. So the way we're built, we have to try to make sense of that. And it seems like we always get first to, well, he must be mentally ill. We don't know that. We don't know that he's mentally ill.
And in fact, the first article that I read about that incident was posing the question, did this person have a mental illness that went undetected?
Exactly.
That was the first question that was asked.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens. I happened to be walking through a store the other day, and I saw a People magazine. It was the March 16th issue of People magazine. And on the cover is, again, 19-year-old, why did a teen kill his parents? Again, a familiar story. So I picked up the magazine because we're thinking about this topic anyway, and I said, here we go again. Here's this 19-year-old boy for some inexplicable reason that looked like a perfectly happy American family, goes in and goes to his parents' home with a gun and shoots his brother and kills his parents. Once again, was he mentally ill? Well, when you read the story, there is no indication that this boy, his name was Ashton Sachs, was, number one, was mentally ill, and number two, was capable in any way of committing such a horrific act. I think at some point you mentioned most of us experience up and downs in our lives, but we don't end up killing our parents
for
that.
Right.
In this case, there were a few things that happened to him. When he was five, his sister drowned in a hot tub. And when he was 6 years old, his parents went through a divorce, but they eventually reconciled and got back together. And the only other thing was, besides the death of his sister at age five, the divorce of his parents at age six, and subsequent reconciliation, the only other thing that happened was in 2013, 2 years before this, he broke up with his girlfriend and he had a suicide attempt. But again, was he clinically depressed or was he just, you know, sad and so he acted out? But 33 days, just a month before he killed his parents, he was talking about his future. He was talking about going to law school. He was talking about future plans. There was nothing in his makeup to suggest that he was capable of such a horrific act. Even after he killed them, he and his older brother were going to adopt the two younger children and take care of them. He was a pallbearer at his parents' funeral, apparently unfazed by this whole thing. Does that mean he's mentally ill? No. No evidence that he was when he committed the act. No evidence that he was before or after. So, again, we have these horrific acts of violence, and yet we don't have an adequate explanation for them. Certainly mental illness is not an adequate explanation for them.
So how do we explain some of these? How do we explain Zohar? How do we explain Ashton? How do we wrap our heads around the idea that, well, for these two particular cases, 19-year-old boys who, for all we know, were doing well, they were succeeding in college, they seemed to have relationships and friends and got along with people. How do kids or even adults who appear otherwise healthy end up committing and engaging in these types of behaviors?
Well, you know, at the risk of sounding a little trite, I think we have to look at each case individually. For example, we all remember the sad story of Adam Lanza and the Sandy Hook massacre, where he killed first his mother and then he went into the school and shot up that elementary school. Adam Lanza, as far as we know, did have a history of mental health and possibly mental health problems. And so in that case, you could say, yes, there was something about his mental illness that may have contributed to this problem. We also know that he was alone much of the time. I think he was homeschooled or taken out of school for some reason. And so he was a lonely kid, possibly with a history of mental illness. The same applies in the Virginia Tech massacre. A couple of years ago, a student at Virginia Tech went on a killing spree, and he had been seeing a psychiatrist just prior to that. But those are clear cases where perhaps mental illness was an issue. But at the same time, you get cases like James Holmes, who shot up the Aurora, Colorado movie theater. And in that case, I mean, though he looks bizarre to us when he's photographed, he has that sort of strange look in his eye that most of us find disturbing. He had dyed his hair orange or red at some point, and he looks a little bizarre when he's photographed in court. But there's, as far as I know, no history of mental illness. And in fact, he had completed college and was a doctoral student in a high-level neuroscience doctoral program at a university in Colorado. So again, when we look for impairment, if mental illness is defined by impairment, where's the impairment here? That he killed people? Is that an impairment? That's another issue. That would make every fighter pilot, every sniper, every military person mentally ill. And we know that's not the case. As far as Zohar Tsarnaev is concerned, once again, no history of mental illness. Based on all the information we have, this was kind of a normal teenager. And it was all teenage stuff on his computer, except for this recurring strand of jihadist literature. And so, was he turned to violence because of his religious beliefs? If that's the case, does that mean he's mentally ill? Certainly, we wouldn't want to accuse a person of being mentally ill because of their religious beliefs, despite how they're expressed. So again, in his case, in Tsarnaev's case, it doesn't look like mental illness. It looks like religious conversion and a particular philosophy based on religious beliefs.
So I think that here it's an important point to make that because a person is suggestible, mm-hmm. either due to religious beliefs or because of their relationships with other people, and then they engage in violent or aggressive acts because of that suggestibility, mm-hmm. that in and of itself does not indicate mental illness.
That's right. That's right. We're hearing all these stories about ISIS right now and the violence that they're perpetrating, and many of us would like to put an end to that, and we'd put an end to it with violence. And so does that make us mentally ill? No, these things don't make us mentally ill. Morally wrong, morally objectionable, possibly. Mentally ill, no.
So with the case of Zohar, it looks like a kid, 19, who was led to commit some of these behaviors by an older brother. And so Zohar was led to those behaviors by someone else. What about Ashton?
Well, it's curious. Ashton didn't seem to have any of those kinds of influences. In fact, the only thing he did say, which to me doesn't explain his behavior, was he wanted his parents to die to make them pay for everything they had done to him. Everything they had done to him. This kid had grown up in an upper middle class family. In fact, more than upper middle class. They were millionaires. And he grew up and had a privileged existence from the time he was born until the time he killed his parents. His mother was a wealthy entrepreneur. And so at this point, we're not sure what he meant by making them pay for everything. because the death of his sister wasn't their fault. They divorced but reconciled. And as far as I can tell, this kid lived a pretty privileged life. So that's as close as we have right now to an explanation. Was he angry with his father for some reason? We don't know. But certainly no clear indications that Ashton Sachs was mentally ill or met criteria for mental illness in any way.
So this brings us to another case, another classic case that we could talk about, and that was, of course, Columbine with Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. And I think that as we have looked back at that case, we know a lot of information about it, but we also still have a lot of questions. I think that information eventually came out that at least one of them may have suffered from depression, but it seems from the reports that we've read that much of that treatment or any potential support that they got for those types of symptoms was sporadic at best. What we also know is that Dylan and Eric seem to be the victims of bullying. And while I certainly don't want to suggest that bullying creates violent reactions, we do know that it happens sometimes, it seemed to be, in the case of Eric and Dylan, that the bullying exacerbated their depression and made things worse for them. The interesting set of circumstances around Eric and Dylan's case is their relative isolation and their ability to engage in a variety of troubling behaviors without anyone knowing anything about it. You know, they had acquired a stockade of weaponry, bombs that they had made. There were reportedly notebooks full of plans that they had about where they were going to set the bombs up in the school and what their time frame was going to be for doing some of this. And there were even videos that they had made of themselves out in the woods shooting guns and other weapons at pictures of some of their bullies as a practice. So that's a case where there was mental illness involved, but that mental illness was exacerbated by their access to violent materials as well as bullying and other issues at the school. You know, there were some that were saying for a while that they thought that all of their victims were their bullies, but they were much more generalized than that. They seemed to be just following a plan and injuring whomever they could injure that they came across. So that's a case where certainly mental illness was involved, may have been associated with it, but I think, again, it's dangerous to say that their mental illness caused those behaviors. I mean, all of us have been depressed before. Not to minimize or not to downplay the seriousness of clinical depression and how awful it makes people feel sometimes, but I'm sure many of you listening to this have experienced depressive symptoms before, but have never imagined going in and killing some of your classmates or workmates or anything like that. So the relationship is an unusual one. And oftentimes, it's other factors that tend to exacerbate that. Now, one little side note that I think is important to make before we move on to another case is with Dylan and Eric, this is when it really hit big, the impact of media and video games and music and those types of things that kids nowadays are exposed to. Now, we're going to have a podcast in the future where we will spend a lot of time focusing on the impact of various forms of media and electronics on our behavior and who we are today. But I think it's important here to point out that, you know, if we remember back in April of 1999 when this happened, one of the first things that became the focus of the blame wasn't mental illness at that time. It was music. It was the video games that they play. And that, too, is a very slippery slope. And again, we'll talk more about that in another podcast, but how many of us have played those kinds of games and, once again, have never committed or even thought about committing such violent acts? If it was a causal relationship, there certainly would be many more killers than there are. Is there a relationship? We will save that for that future podcast, but a relationship is not necessarily causal. So we have to be cautious of that. The next case Dr. Richard's going to tell us about is another very famous case that probably did not involve a lot of mental illness, but certainly included some horrible acts.
You're referring here to the Iceman.
The Iceman.
Yeah, the Iceman. The Iceman is the nickname of a fellow by the name of Richard Kuklinski, with a K. If you want a chilling account of a mass murder, go to YouTube and look up the interview by a forensic psychiatrist of Kuklinski after he was in jail. The short story, give you a little background about Kuklinski. He has confessed to approximately 200 execution-style murders. He was eventually hired by the mafia, in fact, to carry out their executions because he was so efficient. The background on Kuklinski is that he was the only child of parents who were severely abusive. Both mother and father were abusive. And we know from studies, both in humans and animals, that that kind of abuse and neglect actually changes a segment of DNA. And apparently this was the case with Kuklinski, that over the course of a lifetime of pretty significant physical abuse, he turned and he became antisocial. And whenever he had problems with anybody, his solution to that problem was simply to kill the other person. And so this is a case where clearly there were significant events in his life that led to him becoming an antisocial human being who did direct his violence at others with horrific consequences. There is another case. So this is a case where, yes, we have Harrison Klebold, who probably did have some mental illness that was exacerbated. With Kuklinski, we have probably, by all accounts, probably a normal person whose environmental circumstances changed him. So in the case of Harrison Klebold, we have mental illness exacerbated by bullying at school. In Kuklinski's case, we have a personality that was distorted by environmental circumstances. This leads us to that same conclusion, that we have to look at each case individually. And as we move along this spectrum from mental illness to mental illness being exacerbated to mental illness being caused by environmental circumstances, we have to include also the possibility that some violent acts could be the result of structural abnormalities in the brain. And I think Dr. Burney is going to talk about one that I'm sure you all recognize.
I think that's a great segue here, because something that we will, again, talk about in future podcasts, and we will spend some time talking about even here today, is the relationship between mind and body. Now, we're not going to switch over to a very hippie situation here where we're getting all touchy-feely about things, but what we will talk about is the relationship between the brain structurally and how we think and behave. In our field, we call that neuropsychology. There is definitely, absolutely, a relationship between our biology, our chemistry, and our behaviors and choices and emotions. I remember being in graduate school, and the graduate program that I went to was a very behavioral program, and my training prior to graduate school was more medically based, and so I was much more of a person who was into the brain-behavior relationship of neuroscience. And I recall a study being published in 1999 or 2000, somewhere around there, talking about a case where a woman was experiencing Parkinson's disease, and she was undergoing deep brain stimulation. And when they were stimulating particular regions of her brain, she went into a suicidal depression. As soon as they turned the stimulation off, she became somewhat hypomanic and returned to normal within about 5 minutes or so. This woman had absolutely no history of mental illness. And what they discovered was that when they had stimulated her brain, the electrode missed the target by a few micrometers and actually stimulated a region of her brain that seemed to have caused the depressive episode or the mood-related episodes. So with that study and with a number of studies that have come since then, we know very clearly that abnormalities in the brain can cause abnormalities in behavior and abnormalities in emotion. And that takes us to the case of Charles Whitman. Charles Whitman, you might remember, from the University of Texas. He committed, again, horrible acts, killed family members before going to campus and climbing up in the tower and killing a number of University of Texas students and faculty. So what we know from him, what we know from the autopsy of him, is that he actually had a brain abnormality in what we call the limbic system. And that's the area of our brain that regulates emotion, memories, and that is sort of our, they call it our reptilian brain sometimes, because that's the part of us that would behave without reason. And he had a tumor or a growth in that area of his brain that caused the problems that we saw that led to these horrible acts. So here we have a case where we don't have any mental illness up to that point. He was a good student. He was a good friend to people. He interacted well with his family. But presumably as a result of this brain abnormality, we have horrible acts of violence. So I guess what all of this brings us to is that when we see violent acts, or when we read about violent acts, our first question shouldn't necessarily be, did the person have mental illness? Our first question should be, what were the circumstances surrounding the events that led to the violent act? Did the person have medical problems? We were talking a few minutes ago about the German pilot who flew into this French Alps. There was a report that came out earlier today that suggests that he may have had some medical issues that he hid from the airline. Well, they were sure in the article to mention that he didn't have depression or schizophrenia. So one might conclude that we may end up seeing that this guy had other medical issues, not necessarily a mental illness, but other medical issues that would have led to some of those behaviors. And we'll have to sort of wait and see what comes from that investigation. So if we look at these violent acts and we examine the entirety of the situation, sometimes we get a very different impression about what causes behavior or what leads one to act in particular ways, whether it's their upbringing that exacerbates or creates mental illness, or it's mental illness that's exacerbated by events in the environment, organic, or what we call organic or brain-based or biologically based issues, or sometimes nothing at all. Sometimes people behave badly because people behave badly, and there is no predicting or no way to anticipate that.
I think there's another point here that we might want to make as we conclude this discussion, and that is that as we've gone through these various cases, we see this relationship between the brain and behavior, and we know that brain abnormalities can cause unusual behaviors. What we also know is that the stress in our everyday lives can make all of this much worse. So we can begin with a normal individual. Richard Kuklinski comes to mind. And the case of Richard Kuklinski, where clearly the expression of violence was related to the horrific abuse that he suffered at the hands of his parents. So I think what we need to remember here is that in order to understand these acts, we have to look at each individual case. Clearly in each case, the environmental stressors can exacerbate underlying conditions, whether it's a brain tumor or a pre-existing mental illness or just mental health issues. We know that environmental stressors can make things worse. And so, again, look to each case and try to explain each case on a one-to-one basis, but remember the role that environmental stressors play in pushing people to express violent acts against others.
All right, so let's cover our three big take-home messages for the day. The first thing is hopefully we were able to use some case studies to demonstrate that many of the violent acts that we've witnessed and have read about over the last few decades, that the relationship between those violent acts and mental illness is iffy. There's not a firm causal relationship between mental illness and violence. And because of that, we have to be cautious.
And we should think twice before automatically assuming that because someone has a mental illness that they are violent, or that because someone committed a violent act, they must be mentally ill. The relationship there is weak, and it does not justify mental illness as being our first likely suspect for an explanation. The second take-home message is that it is really what Dr. Richard was just talking about, and that is the multifaceted nature of violence. Violence can be created or caused by many different things. Sure, mental illness is one of those things, absolutely. But we are far from being in a position where we can say it is the primary or the number one cause of violence. Other things that can cause violence include, of course, a history of violence, a history of being the victim of violence, other environmental stressors, biological abnormalities, acute stress caused by an emotional or unexpected event. Lots of different things can cause violence. And again, mental illness is just one potentially minor player in that system. And finally, our third take-home message is the fact of environmental stress itself. I think that, again, we have hopefully demonstrated in many of, if not all of the cases that we've presented, the fact that even if there's a mental illness involved, oftentimes violent acts come as a result of environmental stressors that seem to come on just before the violent acts occur. So whether it is losing a relationship, family issues, relationship issues, problems at school, whatever the case may be, environmental stressors are often related to and exacerbate the presence of not only mental illness, but also the likelihood of potential violence. And so, of all the things we've talked about, environmental stressors are the things that we can cope with. Those are the things that we can develop skills and strategies for managing. So whether you are working with a mental health professional or you're working with a life coach or someone like that to develop some of the skills or strategies for dealing with whatever is going on in your life, that increases your ability to cope with many of the mental health conditions and problems that could cause violence and those types of issues. So it will reduce the likelihood that you're going to respond to that stress in an abnormal, unhealthy, or in the case of what we're talking about today, violent way.
So with those environmental stressors, that is something that we can control. That's something that we can take and we can address in a very direct and absolute way. And we have sort of two choices with those environmental stressors. Either we can develop skills to cope with them, accept them for what they are, but develop coping strategies, or we can take the steps that are sometimes very hard steps to take and change them. We can do that for ourselves, we can do that for our children, we can do that for our spouses and other family members, but those are the actions that we can take to reduce the likelihood that we become overbeared by this stress and end up following some maladaptive path to either violence or other inappropriate behaviors and actions. So with that, we thank you guys for listening. We want to thank one of our sponsors, The Ledger, at theledger.com. They graciously assist us with a lot of our work, and they publish our weekly column called The Mental Breakdown. And we want to thank them for all of their help and support. So I'm Dr. Bernie.
I'm Dr. Richard.
And we look forward to talking with you next time.
Thank you for listening to The Mental Breakdown. If you want more information, you can check out our website at www.pacflorida.com. The Mental Breakdown is sponsored in part by theledger.com, where you can read our weekly column in the Live section. Our podcasts are available for download on iTunes, and you can follow us on our YouTube channel and Facebook. We would love to hear from you, so feel free to send us messages either through our website or on Facebook. You can send us questions or topics you would like for us to address on future podcasts. Drs. Bernie and Richard are available for workshops, so you can contact us for more information. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stay mentally healthy.